From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After 35 years of saving victims of war and natural disaster, Fred Cuney became a victim himself. He's assumed to be dead, but his body was never found. In 1995, he mysteriously disappeared on a mission in Chechnya. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Scott Anderson, who retraced Cuney's path through Chechnya and has written a book about Cuney's life and disappearance. We'll also listen back to excerpts of Cuney's interviews on Fresh Air. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the latest CD by Dave Douglas's quintet, and linguist Jeff Nunberg looks at the latest in brand names and branding. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton visited some of the nation's poorest areas today as part of his effort to promote business investment in impoverished rural areas and inner cities. This morning, the president visited the Mississippi Delta, where he announced millions of dollars in community development grants. Later, in East St. Louis, Illinois, he joined an executive from Bank of America to announce the formation of a new $500 million capital investment fund.
There are business opportunities out here. If you got people who want to go to work and people with money to spend, and they're both in the same place, it's a good place to invest.
President Clinton in East St. Louis. The first Russian reinforcements have arrived in Kosovo, adding to the 200 Russian peacekeepers who slipped into the province last month. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports from the Pentagon.
A Pentagon spokesman says about half a dozen Russian planes landed at the airport in Pristina, carrying the first Russians to arrive since June. Nearly a month ago, Russian soldiers raced into the province ahead of NATO peacekeepers and seized the airport. But under pressure from NATO, the nations surrounding Yugoslavia prevented more Russian troops from flying in until now. The Russian troops only arrived after Moscow and NATO leaders agreed on the way Russian soldiers will take part in the peacekeeping force. The Russians will not have their own zone of the country, easing fears of a Cold War-style partition. The Russians will take orders in tactical matters from NATO. But like other peacekeepers, the Russians are still able to refuse orders if they feel the instructions violate their national policy. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, the Pentagon.
Much of the East Coast sweltered through another day of oppressive heat. Many cities set records for high temperatures and for energy use. Connecticut Public Radio's Eileen Albrizia reports from Hartford.
Connecticut's Governor John Rowland ordered all state agencies to cut unnecessary electrical use and asked residents to conserve energy as temperatures reached record highs in Hartford for the second day in a row. Both yesterday and today, temperatures peaked at 99 degrees. Nearly 20,000 Connecticut residents lost electricity due to equipment overload today. About 37,000 people lost power on Monday. The state set a new record for energy use, using 22,500 megawatts, due mostly to power air conditioners. Northeast Utilities was forced to buy power from as far away as Michigan to keep up with demand. About 40,000 commuters between Connecticut and New York were affected by train delays. Because of the heat, power lines over some tracks expanded and dropped, then got tangled in the top of a passing train. For NPR News, I'm Eileen Albrizio in Hartford.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 4 points to close at 11,135. Declines led advances by a slight margin in moderate trading. The average price per share lost 3 cents. This is NPR News. The Labor Department says it's suing Boeing, accusing the giant aircraft company of interfering with investigations into complaints of racial discrimination. The suit accuses Boeing of denying investigators access to its facilities and documents in Seattle, Wichita, Kansas, and Mesa, Arizona. The complaints in Arizona and Kansas stem from complaints that Boeing refused to cooperate with routine investigations to make sure it was complying with guidelines for federal projects. The Seattle lawsuit is based on a complaint of racial discrimination filed by an employee. Composer Joaquin Rodrigo died today at his home in Madrid. He was 97 years old. Rodrigo was Spain's best-known living composer. NPR's Tom Cole reports.
When Joaquin Rodrigo was a very young child, an illness caused him to lose his sight, so he never actually saw with his eyes the royal gardens in the town of Aranjuez that inspired his most famous composition. The second movement from Rodrigo's Concierto de Aranjuez has become one of the most recognizable classical melodies of this century. It's been used in films and TV commercials. Miles Davis recorded the jazz version in 1959. Rodrigo composed it in 1939. It was just his fourth work for orchestra, yet nothing he wrote since has come close to achieving the popularity of the Concierto de Aranjuez. Joaquin Rodrigo will be buried in Aranjuez. Tom Cole, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 4 points to close at 2,737. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the world's most accomplished disaster relief experts, Fred Cuney, mysteriously disappeared in April 1995. He's almost certainly dead, but his body has never been found. He disappeared in Chechnya while assessing humanitarian needs on a mission funded by the Soros Foundation. Cuney was best known as the man who installed the water filtration system in Sarajevo while the city was under siege, which helped keep the city alive. At the end of the Gulf War, Cuney played a major role in developing a plan to resettle the 400,000 Kurds who fled Saddam Hussein's army and were trapped along the Turkish frontier. 7 months after Cuney disappeared in Chechnya, my guest Scott Anderson retraced Cuney's trip through Chechnya, hoping to find out what happened to him. He started the investigation for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. Through that piece, he developed a friendship with Cuney's son, Craig, which made the investigation even more important to Anderson. Now he's written a book about Fred Cuney's life and mysterious disappearance called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. Anderson is a journalist who has spent much of his career reporting from war zones. I asked him to describe Fred Cuney's official mission in Chechnya.
Fred was basically going over to see whatever project he could find that might alleviate the suffering of the refugees. He was going to set up an emergency trauma unit in the next republic over in the Republic of Ingushetia, next door to Chechnya. He wanted to set up a radio transmitter that would, because so many people, over half the country of Chechnya were now refugees at this point, by the spring of 1995. Just basically a radio transmitter that could serve as a clearinghouse for information to repatriate families separated in the exodus. But the thing about Fred is that whatever the upfront strictly humanitarian mission was, he usually had a political agenda. And it's quite clear that when he went back to Chechnya the second time, he very much hoped to basically broker a ceasefire. He had very good contacts with the Chechen rebel leadership. He knew a number of Russian generals from his first trip over. And his idea was to fashion some, at least a temporary ceasefire that then could hopefully serve as a springboard for an all-out political settlement.
I interviewed Fred Cuney in late February of 1995 after his first trip to Chechnya, in which he was assessing humanitarian needs there. And I want to play you an excerpt of that interview. This was his response to my question to give us an overview of what he found.
Well, certainly from an immediate point of view, the biggest single problem is the number of civilians who are still trapped in the southern, southeastern parts of the city. The Chechens are ironically fighting a war in the city to protect a Russian population from Russian bombing. The people who are left are essentially Russian ethnic origin or other Slavic groups. They are elderly. I'd say probably 90% or 70 years or older. They are people who lived in what they call the internats or the welfare homes for the elderly, who couldn't escape. All the Chechens who were there have long gone, and the way the battle unfolded, there was a corridor that was left to the south of the city for people to evacuate, and the Chechens took all their people and left. And so you have now a small number of fighters that are still in the area that are fighting the Russians and pinning them down and making them pay a penalty for being there. But the civilians that are left in that area are all Russians or Slavs. who are increasingly becoming vulnerable to the situation. There's no water, there's no gas or heat, no light. Food supplies are minimal. And the way the war has been unfolding is the Chechens have had small teams that have been able to control the intersections and the roads and fire from buildings, and so the Russians have responded by destroying the buildings. So what's happening is, you know, block by block, the city's being reduced to rubble.
That was relief worker Fred Cuny, recorded in late February of 1995 after his first trip to Chechnya to assess humanitarian needs there. My guest is Scott Anderson, who has written a book about Fred Cuny's disappearance. Cuny disappeared just a few months after this interview was recorded. He disappeared in Chechnya and is believed to be dead, but his body has never been found. Scott Anderson's new book is called The Man Who Tried to Save the World, The Dangerous Life and Mysterious Disappearance of Fred Cuny. When you went to Chechnya in the hopes of either finding Cuny or finding his body, did you have a theory to explain his disappearance or murder?
Yes. I think almost everyone was at that point. I went over about 6 months after Fred had disappeared. At that point, the Cuny family had arrived at the theory that what had happened was that the FSB, the Russian intelligence agency, had been tracking Fred and had very serious problems with him because he had emerged as an outspoken critic of the Russian war effort in Chechnya, and had basically the Russian intelligence had set him up, that they knew the area that he was going into in rebel-held Chechnya, and had spread rumors ahead of his arrival in that area that he was an anti-Chechen spy, and that the three Russians traveling with him were Russian spies. The theory at that time, and the theory that the Cuny family believed, was that the rebels had believed this disinformation campaign by the Russians and had executed the group as a result. That was the theory when I arrived in Chechnya that seemed most people seemed to accept.
When you started traveling through Chechnya, I mean, you were literally walking through minefields. You know, the war was still going on. You could have been, you could have been killed by either side, the Chechen rebels or the Russians. And I think neither of them were particularly interested in getting any deeper into the Fred Cuny investigation. So what was your approach to bringing up at the appropriate time Fred Cuny's name and trying to get information about him?
It was very difficult, and it was something that I was very aware of from the beginning, that I was going into the area. I was going into the area of Chechnya where when I was there in October, November of 95, it had become the main area of fighting. So there was that danger, but then also of asking after Fred Cuny in particular, because it's a very small area you're talking about. All of Chechnya is only the size of Connecticut to begin with. And this whole story of his disappearance, the possible places that he was sighted, was an area of, say, 10 by 12 miles. So it's a very small area. And I was very aware that I'd probably be talking with people who had intimate knowledge of what had happened, or and maybe it had even participated. And so what I tended to do was I presented myself as a journalist working on a story just on the overall situation in Chechnya. But then at some point in these interviews, I would say one story that's very famous in the United States is the disappearance of Fred Cuny. And so I would go on a little tack like that for a little while and just to see what they said, get their reaction when I mentioned his name, but always tried to do it as camouflaged as possible. And in fact, it didn't really work. It was quite clear that people figured out quite quickly what I was there doing. Which gave way to a couple of sort of tricky situations.
Tell us about one of them.
One was in a. I was traveling with a photographer and an interpreter, and we were in this town. We were meeting a rebel commander who had been a commander in the area where Fred had disappeared. And as soon as I mentioned Fred's name, going through, again, and everything was going through this interpreter, I realized that he was very suspicious of me and that he understood far more English than he had let on. And the other complication was the driver we had, the guide who was taking us through Chechnya, was a rebel himself, a Chechen rebel. And we had a lot of interesting situations where he alternately seemed to be protecting us and kind of setting us up. So in this particular day, after this interview that I just instinctively felt went very badly, and I wanted to get out of the town very quickly, our driver said, "Okay, yeah, we'll leave in 5 minutes. I just have to go and talk to some of my cousins." And he was always sort of disappearing on us, saying he was going and talking to his cousins, and when in fact he was going and getting his marching orders from his rebel commanders. So he disappeared, leaving us in this farmhouse for a couple of hours, and came back and said, "Okay, let's go." And so we started down the road and got stopped by a carload of rebels, heavily armed, who took us all to a farmhouse. And we walked into this the courtyard of this farmhouse, where there was probably 15 or 20 rebels standing around, and we were being ushered in to meet the general for the overall region, and the man I had interviewed earlier in the day, who had been, I guess you'd call him a colonel, he was there also. And as I was going in, and it was a very tense situation, and as I was going into the house to be met by the general, this colonel turned to me, and here was a man who had never spoken a word of English to me. It never let on that he spoke English at all. He kind of leaned forward and whispered to me. He said, "Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine." And what the photographer who was with me, his name is Stanley Green, what he learned when he went back to Chechnya about a year later, and he was talking to somebody who knew about that particular incident, and apparently what had happened was that the general had ordered our executions, and in being taken to the farmhouse, the men that were standing around the courtyard were to be our firing squad. And it was actually the colonel I had interviewed earlier in the day who had intervened to save our lives. So that's that story.
So you were really lucky.
Is
this story a reflection on the Chechens' feelings about Fred Kuhne, or their fears about being implicated in his death?
You know, I think it's a reflection of just the madness that was and in fact still is Chechnya, the level of paranoia that existed everywhere with the Russian soldiers in the field, with the rebels. The war zone itself was such a bizarre patchwork quilt of you'd pass villages that were just where there was pitch battle going on, where 2-3 miles away, the Russian soldiers and the Chechen rebels had formed a ceasefire between themselves, and you'd see Russian soldiers coming over selling their weapons to the rebels, and this literally could be 2 or 3 miles from places where it was just pitch battle. So it created this atmosphere where anything could happen at any time, where you couldn't trust anyone. And certainly among the rebels, they had been fed these stories that spies are coming into the area, posing as journalists, posing as relief workers. Mm-hmm. And that happened very quickly in the Chechen War. It's interesting, if you talk to journalists who were there right when it started, that they uniformly found the Chechens incredibly hospitable and very friendly. And really within 2 or 3 months, it had all changed. And you know, at the risk of sounding melodramatic, I've been going to war. It's the only way I know how to kind of put a sort of a comparative statistic to this thing. I've been going to war since 1983, and in all that time, you know, some 15, 16 years, there have only been 5 times in all that time that where I really thought I was finished, where I really thought I was going to die. And 3 of those 5 times were in Chechnya in a 2.5-week period.
My guest is journalist Scott Anderson. His new book about the life and mysterious disappearance of relief expert Fred Cuney is called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott Anderson, and he has reported from several war zones since the early 1980s. Now he's written a new book about the mysterious disappearance and probably murder of relief worker Fred Cuney in Chechnya, and the book is called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. And Scott Anderson tried to track down what happened to Fred Cuney. What information, you know, what actual facts did you finally come up with through your travels through Chechnya?
It seems very clear that Fred's group, Fred and the three people who were with him, were alive for at least 10 days after they were first detained. I became very convinced from traveling around Chechnya that they had never moved out of a rather small area. There had been purported sightings of them everywhere, all across the breadth of Chechnya, even in neighboring republics. There was one story for a while that they were being held in a Russian prison camp in the next republic over. I became very convinced that they had never gotten out of a very small area. As far as, I mean, facts in a place like Chechnya, it's kind of a difficult word
right.
to use there. The one thing that I can say is that three sort of independent accounts came up of what exactly happened, all three saying that the group had been murdered. And interestingly, even though the particulars and the identities of the killers were different, they all centered on the executions taking place on the same day and in pretty much the same area within a mile or two of each other.
So what is your theory now about who was behind the murders?
There's no doubt that they were murdered by the Chechen rebels. I think was very clear. Where it got murky was in trying to figure out why, especially since Fred had such good relations with Chechen rebel leaders from his first visit. I believe that he was ordered executed on by the Chechen rebel self-styled president Dzhokhar Dudayev, who is now himself dead. I believe he is the only person who would have or could have given the order for somebody like Fred to have been executed. And that was the one thing that in the close calls I had in Chechnya that I was aware of among the rebels is that I knew that if something happened to my group by the rebels, somebody higher up would have approved it. With the Russian soldiers, no. I mean, the Russian soldiers were completely undisciplined and just kind of running wild in the countryside. Anything could have happened with them, but when you're dealing with the rebels, they are highly disciplined. So that meant that if the rebels killed Fred, which it seems absolutely certain, then somebody very high up had to have okayed it. And almost the only person that could have been was Dudayev.
What would the motive have been?
It gets very kind of complicated and to the final mystery of the book. The town of Bamut, where Fred had been first detained, was the vortex of the fighting. And it appears that one of the reasons the Russians spent 15 months trying to take Bamut, which is this little town up in the mountains, and lost hundreds of men trying to take it. But the one significant detail about Bamut is that there's an old nuclear missile base there. President Dudayev had been floating out rumors that he had nuclear weapons. And I think that the Russians were so disorganized all through the early 90s, that they weren't sure if Dadaev was bluffing or not. The Russians themselves couldn't be certain that that Dadaev didn't have nuclear weapons. And I think that was why the Battle of Bakhmut was so ferocious. And so what you had was you had Fred Kuhne and three Russian companions rolling through this town where very few people had gone into before in the midst of ferocious fighting. And I'm quite convinced that that had a major role in why they were killed and why we were almost killed there and why other people, I mean, a number of people have disappeared in the Bakhmut area.
Who's investigating the Fred Kuhne case now?
The FBI. The FBI has a Office of Foreign Assassinations. They're the same people investigating the embassy bombings in Africa and the barracks bombing in Saudi Arabia. And they're investigating the disappearance. One significant thing that's happened it happened about a year after Fred had disappeared. They found his passport and the identity papers of the people he was with, right in the town where I thought they had been murdered and buried. So it seems to give some credence to the spot where I think their bodies might be.
Scott Anderson's new book about Fred Kuhne is called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. Anderson will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Fresh Air is also available online at audible.com/freshair.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by trumpeter Dave Douglas. Linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on the latest developments in brand names. And we continue our interview with Scott Anderson. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Scott Anderson, a journalist who has spent much of his career reporting from war zones. He went to the war zone of Chechnya in 1995 when it was trying to secede from Russia. Anderson was investigating the mysterious disappearance of relief worker Fred Cuny, who was last seen in Chechnya 7 months earlier while he was on a humanitarian mission there. Anderson has written a book about Cuny's life and disappearance called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. Cuny was one of the world's best-known relief workers. You say that Fred Cuny's death serves as a reminder of a grim new feature of modern war. No one is safe, even relief workers.
Right. I think what's happened in modern war is that what war has become is a savage slaughtering of civilians. In most war zones I've been in, the safest thing to be is either a soldier or a guerrilla, because there's very little fighting between those two. It's taking turns killing civilians. And I think with this new barbarism in war, what you're also seeing is that both sides don't want to have witnesses to it. It started with the targeting of journalists. At one time, journalists had a certain immunity going to war zones. You started seeing it change most dramatically in Bosnia, where journalists quite quickly figured out that the Serbs were targeting them because they were journalists. And it's happening now with disaster relief people, too. The Red Cross lost more people in Chechnya in one act than in any other single act in their 131-year history. And part of why that is happening is that increasingly, with the end of the Cold War and the breakdown of the clear barriers that once existed between disaster relief, what is disaster relief? What is a military operation? What is an intelligence operation? Now that you have those lines not just blurring, but disappearing completely, combatants in different areas of the world see everybody as a partisan of one side or another, mm-hmm. and as fair game.
There were accusations that Fred Cuny was really a spy, and those accusations, of course, were most dramatic in Chechnya. Mm-hmm. But I think even before that, some people suspect that he must have some kind of CIA-type connections in order to have accomplished what he did and in order to get in the equipment that he needed to accomplish what he accomplished. Do you believe any of those rumors?
No. I know that Fred wasn't CIA, and I think the best proof of that is the way the operation looked of him trying to get his of the American government trying to get his body out of Chechnya. When a CIA agent goes missing or when he's dead, the rest of the world doesn't know about it until the body's out. If you look at the fact that the Cuny family members were down in Chechnya looking for it, the fact that the American government was talking to journalists, if there wasn't other evidence, that in itself would be, to me, is pretty strong proof that that he wasn't. But where I think things get murky with Fred is that he really epitomized this world where the lines are falling away. He was the relief worker has always had this stance of neutrality, this idea that you're not favoring one side or the other, you're just there helping. And Fred really rejected that. He really felt very strongly, say in a place like Bosnia, that you had to make a stand. It was a moral stand, but it was also a political one. He loved the military, and he was often advocating, again, in a place like Bosnia, he wanted the American military or NATO to take a much more activist approach against the Serbs. So within the community that he worked in, he both philosophically represented a departure from them, but also even just physically. Here was a guy, he was 6'3". He had a kind of a military bearing about him. He often talked about, alluded to a military background, which was fictitious, usually had a crew cut. He didn't look like other relief workers, and I think he quite liked the rumors that he was military intelligence or CIA. And I think that within the world that he, the sorts of places he was drawn to, Kurdistan, Somalia, Chechnya, where this post-Cold War chaos is going on, where the boundaries of what's acceptable for a relief worker to do are very hazy. He was in his own element. I think it was quite natural that people started thinking he was intelligence.
My guest is journalist Scott Anderson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Scott Anderson. His new book investigates the mysterious disappearance of Fred Cuney, one of the world's best-known relief workers. I think Fred Cuney was an amazing person, both for what he accomplished and for his for the constant risks that he took over the years to accomplish what he did. And I talked to him a little bit about taking risks in November of 1993 when he was on a brief visit back to the States while he was setting up the water lines in Sarajevo. And I asked him if he had any close calls while doing that work.
Have I had any? Yeah, every day. you know, certainly our vehicles come under fire quite often. Snipers have taken shots at us. We've been very lucky. All our staff, you know, international and as well as our local staff, have not had serious injuries or wounds as a result of this. But we've had a lot of close calls, and some sooner or later, it's probably going to catch up to some of us.
You're not afraid to go out every day and work, or you just do it in spite of the fact that you're afraid?
Well, you'd be a fool not to be afraid. We certainly watch. The news reports and find out where, listen to the radio and find out where the firing is during the day. We know, you know, the areas where sniping occurs, and you certainly know the main areas along the lines of contact where there's a lot of firing, and you avoid those as much as you can. There are routes that go through the city. There's one road we all call the Trail of Tears, where the city has put containers and metal panels and stuff up so that people who are walking from one end of the city to the other have some cover, and our vehicles try and move very rapidly through those areas. But there is no place in the city that's 100% safe, and every day you do run risks. But this is where the people have needs, and you have to go to where the people are in order to provide the assistance. We can't, I don't feel we can back off just because of a risk. These people take the risks every day. We should have to take them as well if we're going to provide humanitarian assistance.
Scott Anderson is a journalist who's taken plenty of risks yourself in war zones, reporting on wars. What do you think about hearing those comments from Fred Cuney?
It's interesting. It reminds me of stories I've heard of Fred in Sarajevo, and one in particular where somebody said that on the heaviest, the shelling could be so heavy that even cats wouldn't go outside. You could see Fred just walking down the street. His next-door neighbors, when he was living in Sarajevo, would be cowering in their living room during shelling and sniper attacks. And they'd see Fred walk out of the house, going to get into his van, and he'd just, like, wave to him, smile, get in and drive away. He was, I think that Fred, obviously, he was an extremely courageous man. I think another key to him is that from a very early age, I think from the time he was first cognizant, really, he saw life as theater, and he had an epic sense of himself. One of the most revealing things that I've seen about Fred, after he disappeared, his family found something he'd written right around the time of his 30th birthday, it seems. It wasn't dated, but he was at least 20 years old, and he had written out this list of what he wanted to accomplish in his life, and the list went on for five single space pages, and it was divided into 15 different categories. You know, everything from designing a spaceship to climbing the Matterhorn to being the captain of a schooner to flying a blimp. He wanted to live for 400 years. And I think that from an early age, I think one of the keys to understanding his ambition is that he wanted to be at the center of great events. And in particular, in the context with Sarajevo, it was interesting. I was there in the summer of 96 after the peace had been declared there, and all of a sudden the place was overrun with disaster relief humanitarian aid groups. And talking to a friend of Fred's from that time, and you know, this friend said, you know, so many people say, God, yeah, I really wish Fred was here because he could sort out all this chaos, you know, of all these different agencies tripping over each other. And this friend saying, Fred wouldn't be caught dead in this place now. You know, there's too many do-gooders around. He always wanted to be out on the you know, on the frontier where he could shine.
As someone who's taken plenty of risks yourself to report on war, are you particularly interested in the type of personality who gravitates to work involving great risk?
I think I am, yeah. And hearing Fred talk about what it was that kept drawing him back, it sounds very similar to the motives that draw me back to it. And they're not all these sort of selfless motives. It's, I think, for Fred, as for me, part of it is the thrill, the sense of war, despite all its awfulness, is also a very thrilling thing to experience. And I think you can get addicted to the adrenaline snap you get from being in combat situations.
So what impact did it have on your willingness to take risks, to nearly lose your life a couple of times while searching for somebody who did lose his life doing his work?
You know, it's funny. I almost have to put it in like sort of pop psych or self therapy terms. I had never really kind of thought about it before, but it, in the same way that, you know, they talk about like alcoholics have to hit their own version of a rock bottom, I think I'd probably gotten a bit, you know, actually had been become addicted to the adrenaline jag you get from being in war situations. And for me, Chechnya was kind of my rock bottom. I realized that I was very, very lucky to have gotten out. And I think it made me reappraise the way I was living my life. I think that the lure of those places has diminished a great deal for me. There's still a bit of a yank when something happens in the world, but I don't think that I would ever get myself into who knows? I say it's very easy to say that now. I mean, I think I wouldn't get into a situation quite as crazy as Chechnya was. But you know, I mean, what happens is when you're out there, things that seem like a horrible idea when you're sitting here, they have a way of not seeming that awful when you're there, especially if you're in a group of people. This kind of a group psychosis tends to set in, I think.
You had become friends with Fred Cuny's son, Craig. And I'm wondering if Craig wanted to know a lot about your life taking risks to better understand his father's life taking risks?
Not so much. It's funny. Craig and I, he's one of my best friends now. In fact, I bought a pickup truck from him, and I was in his wedding party when he got married a few months ago. But we have this funny relationship when it comes to what happened to his father and to Chechnya. We've never really talked about it that much. It was a difficult thing for me when I was working on the book, in that I never wanted to feel like I was trading on a. I never had, obviously, I never had such a close friendship with a person who was a source before. And never wanted to get into a situation where I felt like I was trading on the friendship to get new information. But I think Craig is also very much the son of his father. He also has this this renegade streak and this sort of adventuring streak. I think that for both of us, I don't know, it's sort of that macho thing of just you just sort of suck it up and don't talk. I mean, he certainly had a lot of close calls when he was in Chechnya looking for his father. I had a few, but it's never been stuff we tend to talk about. We've talked about it a little bit, but we tend to, I don't know, we talk about sports or something else.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Scott Anderson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Scott Anderson's new book about Fred Cuny is called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. We're listening to music from Dave Douglas's new CD, Convergence. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says two trends that have produced much bad music in the past, jazz plus strings, and jazz musicians playing world music, have now evolved to where they're often resulting in good music. As evidence, Kevin reviews this new CD by Dave Douglas's quintet, which includes a string trio along with trumpet and drums. The band has been together since 1992. Kevin says they might be the best of the busy trumpeters' several groups.
Like other ambitious musicians, trumpeter Dave Douglas keeps a few groups more or less active at the same time. If, like him, you're curious about all kinds of music, from funk to jazz standards to the Viennese serialists, having a few bands is a practical option. For one thing, you don't have to find other musicians who are as versatile as you are. But if you can find such players, you're really in luck. In Douglas's quintet with three strings, everybody keeps up. They hear ideas from all over the map and the musical spectrum and make it all a common language, or at least a plausible con. Dave Douglas on trumpet. The third CD by his quintet is Convergence on the Soul Note label. They play a batch of originals, as well as Kurt Weill's Bilbao song, an organ piece by Messiaen, and one real stunner, a tightened-up adaptation of a fanfare from Burma. Let's start with the field recording it's based on and then switch to the remake. Dave Douglas's quintet with Michael Serene on drums. That piece is a dazzler for the perfect blend of trumpet and strings, and for how the quintet infuses Burmese music with so much New York attitude, which, of course, is a beautiful thing. Much applause for the strings. Drew Grass is on bass and Eric Friedlander on cello. Violinist Mark Feldman has played with Dave Douglas for a long while now, and they're good mutual foils. Each helps bring out the other's best instincts. Feldman has big ears as an improviser, but can also lob a melody right over the plate, like his boss. That's one reason this group works. They know when to blow like crazy and when to just play the tune.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Convergence, the new CD by Dave Douglas's quintet. Coming up, why product brand names don't mean what they used to mean. This is Fresh Air. Brand names like Ford, Colgate, Ivory, Heinz, Gillette. Brand names used to connect a product to a manufacturer, but it's not so simple anymore. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts on branding.
Amtrak is trying to perk up its image again, and they've just announced they're introducing a new brand name to designate their service, Acela. Acela isn't supposed to be the name of a railroad line or of a particular train like the Orient Express or the 20th Century Limited. The idea is that it's going to be a brand name for the experience of rail travel. As one spokesman put it, Acela reflects the feeling of what the train means. It's an indication of just how far the branding business has come. Branding began, of course, when people burned marks into the skins of cattle or criminals, the first to indicate ownership, the second to indicate reputation. And the first commercial uses of branding had something of both significations about them, when winemakers started to burn their marks into the sides of casks early in the 19th century. By the end of the century, the notion had been extended to a whole range of consumer products that manufacturers had begun to package, label, and promote on a national scale. It was the age that gave us all of those brand names that are part of the American consciousness, like Colgate, Ivory, Kodak, Heinz, Wrigley's, and Gillette, all duly registered under the trademark laws that were enacted around this time. But it was left to 20th century marketers to extend the branding concept to commodities that were increasingly immaterial, first retail outlets and restaurants, then services like law, accounting, and sewer cleaning, till finally we've reached the point where we have brand name religious groups, brand name psychotherapies, brand name charities, brand name colors and flavors. And of course, the digital age has set off a new brand rush in things like processors, programming languages, and search engines. For a long time, I figured the branding process had reached its logical culmination when Volkswagen started promoting the brand Fahrvergnügen, the unpronounceable name of an impenetrable concept that was apparently drawn from Hegelian metaphysics. But Amtrak's Acela gives this one a run for its money. Branding has been changing in other ways, too. Back in the days when wine merchants were burning their names into casks, it was a simple matter of associating a particular product with a particular manufacturer. Over time, though, the connections have been weakening on both ends. On the one hand, we often have no idea who's on the other end of the branding iron, particularly as brand names are freely traded from one manufacturer to the next. Starting this year, Rolls-Royces are going to be made by BMW, and Bentleys are going to be made by Volkswagen, though they'll be selling them in the same showrooms. On the other hand, the connection between brands and products has been attenuated, as manufacturers feel free to extend or license their brand names to items that have nothing to do with the products they were originally attached to. Brands have become like butterflies, which flutter down the aisles of the store, trailing their scents behind them and lighting wherever they see a likely shelf. You walk into the opticians, and they have lines of sunglasses that bear the names of Porsche, Armani, and Hobie. It's a real test of brand loyalty, I suppose. What does a Porsche-driving, Armani-shirted surfer do when he's faced with that array? But of course, nobody takes these connections literally anymore. It's just a question of which incantation you want to have scrawled alongside your temple. Linguistically speaking, they're a curious category. Words like Coca-Cola and Chevrolet are among the most frequent common nouns in English, and certainly no other part of the vocabulary is growing more rapidly. And yet, we tend not to think of these as English words at all. They aren't really our collective property the way that dictionary words are. It isn't for us to decide what they mean. They belong to that huge chunk of language that's been privatized over the last 100 years or so. It's one of the most striking developments of modern market capitalism. Certainly neither Adam Smith nor Marx could have foreseen the day when people would pay several $100 million to own a string of syllables. We often think of ourselves as living in a material age, but since the late Middle Ages, there's never been a civilization that attached such a value to mere words, or that was willing to pay for them so dearly.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sherrock. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by Morphine, which used unusual instrumentation for a rock band, a two-string bass, drums, and saxophone. The bassist and lead singer, Mark Sandman, died of a heart attack Saturday during a performance in Italy. He was 47.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Bantam Books, publishers of Neurotica by Sue Margolis, a debut novel about a reporter who will do anything for a good story. Available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the Army's former top counterintelligence officer, Stuart Harrington, about catching American spies who have become traitors. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.